Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 688. What's coming up on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
Well, I've got an app for today because I'm real excited about that Jurassic World coming out. And James Miller, one of our listeners, has created an app called Pose and Draw Dinosaurs. And it is an art app designed for you to set up and learn how to draw 22 different dinosaurs. And I'm going to be honest, I have downloaded it and it's amazing. And it works in tandem with a bunch of art programs for the iPad. I'm real into doing art on the iPad so that you can lightbox things or different stuff or go the old-fashioned way with doing stuff. It's free, and then there's actually a $1 upgrade is the one in-app purchase, and it is a real cool app. It's a little kid-oriented, but I'm a 28-year-old man who played with it for 2 hours yesterday.
What do you got, Katie?
I just want to remind people that we have Orphan Black's official podcast now on the Nerdist Podcast Network. It's called Clonecast, and it comes out every Wednesday, so it's out today. And they get a lot of cool people from the TV show, so anyone who likes the show will love it.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I also have to congratulate Kyle for being really great the other night.
Thanks. Yeah. It was
in
fun.
The Nerdist stand-up cluster. Kyle Clark had a killer set.
Telling the he jokes.
Did.
That was
Everyone
a good,
did great.
That was a good lineup. That was
yeah,
really fun.
Good group of folks on there.
I think the way we're going to, I'm probably going to cut me out as much as possible just so that it's, so that the show is tighter.
2 hours long?
Just the comics. So that'll be good. We'll put that up soon.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was, I had posted somewhere that it was a real surreal experience because I definitely remember being just a dude who listens to the Nerdist podcast, listening at first stand-up cluster and going like, oh my God, Jonah Ray doing stand-up. This is amazing. And to, like, you know, years later actually be on, like, the third one. Like, it's a real crazy cluster of folk to have all get to be in the short list on with. So it was pretty cool. I was talking to Dan Telfer about it, and we were both like, that's kind of weird, isn't it?
Well, you were great. So
thank you.
Thanks for bringing the heat, Kyle Clark.
Man,
and everyone had great sets.
Yeah,
this was a fun night.
It was
night.
A quality program.
I was very excited about it. We're going to be doing stand-up. We're doing podcasts. I believe we're about to do announce a second A late show podcast at San Diego Comic-Con on the Saturday night. And then I'm doing Fun Comfortable stand-up tour on the Friday night. So if you go to funcomfortabletour.com, then you can get tickets to that. And then I'm doing Montreal, the Just For Last Montreal, and Just For
Last. I think this is going to be your year, man.
In Toronto. So that's
what
all
if you just popped upon new faces just to the horror of all the other people? What is he doing here?
Yeah,
that'd be so good.
I don't know if I would have a good set, to be honest, because I'm so used to doing long form stand up now that when I try to condense into 6 minutes, like it feels weird.
I'm
to
upset because I'm starting to get that way, and I have no reason to. But like I did my first couple of like headlining spots recently and got to do long. I'm like, oh, this is way better. This is so much better.
That's great. It's good fun. This episode of the podcast, Joseph Gordon-Levitt returns.
Ooh. Oh, he's the best.
He was so great.
I truly love
again.
That man.
You know, he was on a couple of years ago, and the episode particularly resonated with people because he's a very thoughtful guy, and we talked about a lot of really, I don't know, like very personal stuff, and people really dug it, and you know, obviously when someone comes back, you're like, well, I hope they have fun again, and this time was. Just as fun.
He's such a good dude.
Yeah, he is a good dude.
He's so smart, too.
Yeah, he's shockingly smart. And, I mean, to the extent where you feel a little intimidated.
No, yeah. I feel like everybody heard him talk that first one. Like, oh, we're all stepping up our game right now, I see.
Oh, I see. Oh, we have to be present. He's promoting Hit Record. The new season starts June 12th on Pivot. And now, here's Nerdist Podcast number 688 with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Going.
What's up, dude?
Nice to see
good
you.
To see you.
Welcome
back. Hey, how are you?
Nice to see you too.
You got dressed up for us.
Yeah. I did. This is a bit. Did you see the red carpet outside?
We totally passed it.
I love that you put a rain slicker on Scout. That is.
He's the only one who came prepared for the weather.
She. I'm just seeing boobs. I always forget if Scout's a.
Okay. Dog. Everyone says he for dogs. I'm like.
Everyone says he for dogs and she for cruise ships.
And she for cats.
She's delisting.
Well, thanks for being a pretty chill dog owner. That's real. That explains why. And this dog will sit there and that's the entire time. And just curl up and be a freaking cool dog.
She's a social creature. She knows what's going on in the room.
This dog has been in most of the podcasts that we've done for the last, year and a half or something
this
like
dog's
that?
Been a lot of things.
That's why the dog's so chill. It's just like, yeah, whatever.
Couldn't care less.
Just couldn't care less anymore. In the beginning, I wanted to take pictures with everyone and get autographs, and then now it's
ask their opinion on the news.
Now it's just put my rain slicker on me. I'm going to be over here. I don't give a shit anymore. It's good to see you again.
Likewise, man. Likewise.
The first time you came on the podcast, people talked.
Are we recording already?
Yes.
It's is that how it happens? This okay.
Yeah. You sort of get blindsided with it.
I'm glad I asked.
Let me give you a little information behind the Matrix code.
Okay.
It's mainly so that people don't feel like, and now me telling you this, I don't know if this is helpful. It's basically, because you're so used to doing interviews. People are so used to doing interviews, and I want it to be a conversation. And so when you go, okay, it is time to start.
Yeah.
Sometimes people's shields go up.
Right, right.
Like, now I am into an interview mode.
See, that's funny because at the beginning of every hit record episode, we start off saying, are we recording? And that comes from a certain thing that my brother and I used to always do because you've run into those situations enough times where something cool is happening, you want to record it, and then you do, and then you're like, okay, let's watch it back. Fuck, I wasn't recording that. So you check at the point
you
before you get started, you say, are we recording? And you make sure that that's actually happening.
Yes. Well, first of all, congratulations on hit record.
Thank you. That wasn't just a shameless segue into already plugging my show.
Please, plug the show.
It was.
Plug the show.
But it was so well done that I'm not ashamed of it.
You know, it reminds me of something else I saw on hit record.
Why are we all suddenly wearing red buttons?
This is crazy.
What's happening?
Are we recording? Yeah. But the last time you were on the podcast was a couple of years ago, and it was an episode that people talked about to me for months and months.
Is
and
that
months.
Right? Oh,
yes,
cool, man.
Because it took this really wonderful turn, and we talked a lot about your brother, and it was it felt really nice, and I think
I feel the same way. By the way, and I'll say people have brought that interview in particular up to me. Probably as much as or more than any interview I've ever done. That's really true.
That's really cool, and it's really nice to have you back. And
well, likewise. Now we're gonna recapture the magic. How's your brother?
No,
I wasn't there.
I don't think you were there. Maybe that's not the right question.
Actually, that was very much the right question. That was the perfect question.
I wasn't there. I'm now remembering.
Matt, he's with
now,
my dad.
He's with
my
dad.
They're bowling.
Yes,
that's what thunder is.
You know, this is Matt. this is Matt.
Yeah, hey Matt.
And a Red Sox hat. Are you not a Red Sox fan?
I'm from LA, dude.
Oh, okay.
I can't root for any Boston teams.
Okay, yeah, you understand. Matt,
you know,
do you root for them? Really root for them?
The Red Sox?
Yeah.
I literally was watching them play the Orioles before I came here.
How was that going?
0-0 in the fourth.
Oh, okay.
You know, pitch count's a little high on Rodriguez.
I'm already lost. But I'm glad to know that it's a thing that's happening. So Dodgers are playing currently? We're in baseball
season. I think he's more a Lakers fan and hates the Celtics.
You have that exactly right.
Oh, okay, that's what it is.
You have that 100% correct. That's right.
Matt has a sports sense, so he can tell.
I know what's happening. Yeah. I hate the Lakers. Yeah. What are you going to do? Yeah.
Now, when you like a team, what is it that you like specifically about it? Like, what makes you go? Is it local pride, or is it something about the way that they're managed?
That's a question I ask myself all the time. You know, sports is funny because you get invested. It's different than a movie. When you love a team and you watch a game, you're investing a lot of time in watching that game, and you're just as likely to feel like shit at the end of the night,
yes,
as you are to feel good, because if they lose, you're screwed. Your whole emotional state will be ruined for the night. So why do we pick teams? I don't know. It's like a tribal thing or something.
I mean, guess.
Yeah. It's geographic.
Yeah.
It's really just like sort of like your roots, or, you know, that's your city. You choose that to be your city.
My mom will have specific reasons. It's like, I like this coach.
Oh, I can give you reasons why the Lakers, the 1980s Magic Johnson Lakers, are the best sports team of all time. I can give you lots of reasons for that.
I don't know, but let's just talk about the 80s Celtics with Larry Bird, basketball Jesus.
Did you hit record? Because this is about to get magical.
Well, okay, let's talk about it then. Because
sure.
Larry Bird is more like the category of Michael Jordan, who's an awesome player,
right,
on his own and makes great shots and all that. But mm-hmm. Magic Johnson is someone who is able to unite a team and orchestrate teamwork in a way that is far more entertaining for me, anyway, as a watcher, than just an individual guy who's a great player on his own.
Watching Larry Bird make everyone look like an idiot. I like him trash talking. If you go back, there's a great the 3-point contest at the All-Star game in, I think, 86 or 87. Larry Bird just runs the table on the threes, and then he just throws the last one up from the corner, doesn't even watch it, and just walks away and then nails it. It was amazing. He's the best.
I can watch highlight reels because I'm like, oh, you know, these are the peak moments of the thing. Like,
right.
I get to see everyone shining, you know, the thing that they've trained their whole lives for is connecting right here, and it's working.
Part of it's I just like the pacing of sort of watching things on television. I like when the announcers don't have anything to talk about, so then they just start talking about the food that they had that day. It's like a real sort of like, all right, let's just let this happen.
But also highlight reels, you don't have the suspense.
That's
because
true.
Every play on a highlight reel, the ball's going through the hoop.
Yeah.
So you're not on the edge of the seat to see if it goes in or not.
That's true. That's true. But a lot of times, you know, I'll make my way through a video game and then I'll go back with the cheat codes and then just run through it really fast.
Right.
So maybe that's
so. So cheaters like highlight reels is what you're saying.
I think that's what we've arrived at.
Now, to be fair, I did say I would play through the first time.
You did say that.
And then I would like to run through with
and that's
with the
important.
Cheat codes.
See, I've just never won a video game ever.
No.
Not for lack of trying. That's not true. I've beaten Street Fighter. That's
Street
it.
Fighter. Okay. Yeah.
I think we talked about Street Fighter last time. That's really my only video game that I'm good at.
And by the way, Street Fighter is one of those games that you can still play and it's still fun.
Oh, completely. And I this is probably biased, but I hold the opinion that it's still better than any of the newfangled Street Fighter descendants. Any Mortal Kombat, Tekken, anything is none of them have the finesse and the subtleties that Street Fighter has.
First of all, I appreciate that you're already using grandpa language like newfangled.
These
newfangled games.
Chicken games.
We used to say, finish him, and then we'd finish him.
That's
Mortal Kombat.
That's
Mortal Kombat, yeah.
Mortal Kombat.
I want to confuse the two.
But that's Mortal Kombat's the one that I played. Because that's the one we had at UCLA. There was a... There was an arcade, and they all had the winners don't use drugs things on there.
It's true.
Yeah, but then I would lose, and I'd be like, so should I take drugs now? Like, I don't know.
Answer is also yes.
As a personal message. I mean, I didn't win. It says winners don't use drugs. Losers must use drugs. So I don't know. I was but Mortal Kombat was kind of my, you know, and I stand by the Mortal Kombat movie. I stand by the old Mortal Kombat.
The Mortal Kombat movie is better than the Street Fighter movie. That's true.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
Are there any things from your childhood that as you're older and you have more sway with things? You know, I think I got to make that a thing. I think I got to make a movie out of that, or I got to go back and resurrect that.
Oh, well, I could only probably tell you about things that, you know, haven't moved forward and therefore would be embarrassing for everyone involved to talk about.
But you've tried. You've tried.
I had what I thought was a really cool idea for Choose Your Own Adventure that they didn't take my
idea. A movie? You Choose Your Own Adventure as a movie?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That sounds... But I mean, how does that even, does the whole theater choose at one time, or do you?
You know, there was talk of that. I don't think the technology is quite there yet to do that. Right. I think that's coming.
They clap and a guy has to change a reel. Oh, yeah, fuck.
I think eventually that, and probably sooner than later, stuff like that will happen where like a cinema full of people are all using their own devices and influencing the story that you're seeing up on the big screen.
Okay. When someone gives you $1 billion for hit record, what you got to do is you got to rent out the Arclight. Mm-hmm. You shoot 5 different adventures.
Does this exist already?
What?
It already exists.
But did they,
that doesn't sound the
but
same.
But did they
though.
Know? Like, did they know that their reactions were influencing the movie?
The movie was different based on the movie.
Right, right, right.
But they weren't really choosing.
But they weren't actively choosing.
No, that's more like they were. He was algorithming your own adventure.
Not the
like
same.
It wasn't really.
But was he? How was he getting input from the audience, by applause or by what?
By weird reactions. Yeah.
Just watching them.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. That's
not,
what that
not,
movie
not
was.
Choose your own adventure.
No.
And who's that kid's name? What's his name?
Frank.
Never gonna work out. Yeah, that's why it didn't.
Wait, go back to making wine.
Can I just ask a technical question? You don't have a microphone in front of you. Are we hearing you?
Yo.
We're not supposed to like pretend that he's not talking or something.
No, I mean we do that, but it's not required.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Follow-up question or anything, or no? We're good.
No, I just wanted to understand. I
was
confused.
I couldn't help with that because I just read that article on that thing, and so I had that knowledge.
That thing that was different from what we were talking about?
It's different than Choose Your Own Adventure. Like, Choose Your Own Adventure would be, at a certain point in the movie, you could say, like, you know, if you want to pick this, go to theater 2. If you want to pick this, go to theater 4. If you want to pick this,
interesting. Do it with the whole cinema.
And then everyone has to get up, and then they all go to the theater. And then at the very end, they all come back. The ending somehow gets tied together in 4 or 5 different ways.
That's interesting.
When you have $1 billion and you can rent out a theater and shoot 5 different movies.
I mean, these are the kinds of things that I think about, and I don't know if it's going to be quite like Choose Your Own Adventure, but I do really think that eventually there will be a thing where lots of different people are all gathered in one place and, you know, working with their devices in various ways. And there's some sort of, you know, master of ceremonies or dungeon master, whatever you want to call it, who's sort of got, you know, the finger on the control button of what's going up on the big screen.
Yep.
And it is sort of a largely collaboratively told story.
You know, maybe you were a little ahead of your time, but it's still not over. You got plenty of time to make this happen.
But my idea for Choose Your Own Adventure was much more conventional than that. They didn't throw me out of the studio because I was trying to raise $1 billion to hit record. I just thought. I don't know. Is it weird to like pitch a rejected pitch
on
a podcast?
No, please.
Does that happen?
Not at all. Because then someone will be like, "We have to kickstart that," and then the next thing you know, you have $10 million.
My idea for Choose Your Own Adventure was to do it sort of like how you know in Neverending Story, there's the world of Bastion reading the book.
Yes, of course.
And then there's the world within the book.
Yes.
That's the basic idea of how I wanted to do a Choose Your Own Adventure, where you had like a character, probably two characters, like maybe two kids or something, a brother and a sister or something like that, who are reading Choose Your Own Adventure together and go through the book once, and it happens one way, and then maybe like later in life, the younger sibling comes back and goes through the book again, but it happens differently. And so, or something like that, where the emotional stakes are coming from the character who's reading Choose Your Own Adventure book. But they kind of just wanted to, you know, do, you know, just a big action movie and call it Choose Your Own Adventure.
So are people choosing?
No. No.
Well,
technically,
is it an adventure movie? No, it's action.
They chose.
No, not at all.
The second they bought a ticket, they chose this adventure.
They chose this adventure.
So,
what's to say? You choose a lot of things in a movie. Am I going to get good and plenties? Am I going to get popcorn? Am I going to pee right now? Am I going
to
wait?
They are choosing it.
So
they drink too much. They have to go to the bathroom. That's part of the adventure.
Choose your own adventure if you think about it. I'm a 50s studio head.
So have we got a deal?
Louis Mayer said to me once, go fuck yourself. Yeah, I really feel like this, it's the kind of thing that the more, especially the more that things can be crowdfunded and the more that, you know, technology essentially makes it easier for people. I mean, you really could just make, you could make most things right now on your own. I mean, I don't think it's out of the, I don't think it's out of the question. You don't need the big Hollywood machine.
Well, the funny thing to me is that, the technology is actually ahead of the culture. Like that, with the technology that we have now, we could be doing a lot more progressive things that are way, you know, kind of beyond what storytelling culture is today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually not the technology that limits us at this point. It's the fact that we're just not used to doing that. And we think of stories as, right, a story is something where I sit on a couch and listen, and someone tells me a story. And that someone is someone I never get to meet, and they just live on the other side of the screen, and they take my money, mm-hmm. and that's it. That's what a story is. But if we just kind of changed our minds about that, and was like, no, a story is something where we all gather together, some of us are in the same room, some of us aren't in the same room, whatever, and we all kind of have our, you know, our contribution to make on what this story is.
Yeah.
Then, and by the way, I think that's kind of the more natural way that stories happen. Probably if you go back thousands of years, and forgive me if I said this to you before, because this is the story, this is like the thing I always bring up and I always like to think about, is that if you go back thousands of years and, you know, you have earlier human beings gathering around a fire to tell a story or something, I doubt that there were 100 people sitting quietly while one or five people told or acted out a story. That's not how it went. I'm sure someone talked for a certain amount of time until someone else or a few other people were like, no, that's not how it went. This is what happened. And then someone else is like, oh, but I heard blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And then, you know, you come back to the fire next week and someone tells a story and it's got a new twist. And that's, I feel like, the more natural way. Human beings tell stories in sort of social, collaborative ways.
Choose your own cave.
Choose your own cave.
You know, I think this is sort of like, have you been to any of the haunted house, like Sleep No More, or any of the haunted house adventures?
I went to Sleep No More in New York City, yeah.
Every time I'm there, I never have a night off. I'm only usually there working. My girlfriend's been, and she loves those and like escape the room type stuff.
Mm-hmm,
and I know
mm-hmm.
they're different, but you know, that kind of immersive storytelling
right.
is really interesting too.
What I thought that Sleep No More, and forgive me if I'm talking about something that only a few people in New York have gotten to experience, but I thought it was beautiful. The whole look of, I mean, what it is, just to summarize it, is it's like this five-floor building where they've production designed the hell out of it, and there's tons of rooms and beautiful set design.
Was it a walk-up?
there's elevator
Great.
And stairs.
I'm in.
Yeah. And there's also these sort of performers moving about. They're kind of actors, kind of dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Performance artists or something. They don't talk so much. And so the audience, everyone kind of just walks through and gets to observe and sort of go into whatever room they want and see what's happening. And they say that it's a retelling of Macbeth. And my takeaway from it was, I just wish they didn't tell me it was a retelling of Macbeth, because it's not. Like, there's no, maybe kind of, but not, like, there's no, I couldn't find where the Macbeth story was, and I was looking.
Yeah.
And actually, as soon as I stopped looking, like two-thirds of the way through the night, I was like, you know, maybe I should just give up on this whole Macbeth idea. I started enjoying myself a lot more.
So yeah. you allowed yourself to experience the thing.
Yeah, once I was just like, God, this all looks amazing, and stopped thinking about, what's the story? Whoa, is there a story? I want to follow it. What's this character doing? What's their motivation? Like, because there wasn't any, really.
Well, now there's a bunch, and I mean, not surprisingly, a lot of them pop up around Halloween, but there's a lot of types of immersive events like that, but there are degrees to which you can allow the performers to touch you.
Right.
So in some of the scarier ones, it'll be dark and they'll just fucking grab you and like
right.
yank you into another room and I'm not
throw you in a baby cradle
throw
and
you in
take
a baby
you for
cradle.
A ride. Yeah.
I may not be okay with that. But finding different ways, and particularly now with, you know, I mean, are you playing around with Periscope or any new social media tools to tell stories at all?
I haven't really played with Periscope much. No, that's like the live streaming.
It's a live streaming app.
Yeah, I mean, I think
really
that's
fun.
Really exciting. I should play with it more. Is it, how's the delay on it? Is my question.
It's not terrible.
It's pretty
good. And you know what's fun about it is that. I feel like there's a slight philosophical approach between using that versus just putting up a video on YouTube.
Right.
Which, you know, YouTube, for the most part, I feel like, oh, here's a moment that got captured. But now people are getting closer and closer and closer to wanting to be in the moment of things, almost like we're almost going to travel back in time.
Yeah.
But it really captures very special moments. And it's really cool just to think that, you know, at any given time, you could. I mean, obviously, we've had live streaming for a long time, but just not something as simple that was adopted by a lot of people.
Yeah, I gotta try it. I definitely have to try it.
I mean, Twitch is great, but you know, but if you're just out in the world and something happens, or you're gonna try something, or you just want to talk to people, it's a great tool. I really like it.
I have a fantasy. You know how on live broadcasts, you'll have a bunch of different cameras in the studio or in the arena or whatever, and then you have like a control room and someone's like, ready, camera two, go, camera two, blah, 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 and they're able to switch the cameras. Wouldn't it be cool if, and maybe this exists already, I just don't know, if it were like a live streaming thing like that and everyone's phone could all connect to a hub like that and you could kind of switch back and forth between...
Like Cerebro.
Sure Batman had that.
You're right.
He might have been around for that.
He was the world's greatest detective. I'm just picturing like Professor X and Cerebro where he just puts the helmet on and then he can see everything.
Right.
You know, he can see every mutant all over the world. It's that kind of... That you could see all those sorts of points of view.
You know what's funny is thinking about that... That's that whole sequence, which is towards the end of the second Nolan Batman movie, the Dark Knight, and maybe before it's called The Dark Knight, and where he has all those cameras.
Yeah,
I've thought of that a lot recently because I just got finished shooting a Snowden movie.
Oh yeah, the Oliver Stone one.
Yeah, and I feel like no one talked about it that much in 2008 when The Dark Knight came out.
Right.
About the implications of what Batman has right there at the end of the movie.
Well, Lucius knows it's no good,
and he's very cautionary towards it. It's true, but it was just a few years before we really started as a in a more popular way paying attention to the concerns over mass surveillance.
I mean, it's fascinating. We're all walking around with microphones and cameras,
at all times, you can broadcast. Ostensibly just broadcast to the world at any time.
Yeah, but not even that. I mean, just the thought of the backdoor access to that thing,
right?
Through a server.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Did you talk to... You must have talked to Nolan about that at some point or other, right? Did you ever talk to him about it?
You know what? I haven't spoken to Chris about Snowden yet, and I look forward to when next I get to talk to him, and I'll be very curious to hear what he thinks.
Well, I mean, but also in terms of... philosophical implications of technology, and I mean,
well, you know, Chris is somewhat of a Luddite. Like, he doesn't
really,
he doesn't have a cell phone.
The man still
he doesn't
wears
have
suits
an email address.
Wow.
He, I mean, you know, his wife and producing partner Emma does, and so and they, you know, work very closely together. So there's that. But yeah, he's pretty resistant to a lot of the new technology.
Oh wow, that's
maybe he's changed since last we spoke about it. But
I mean, I feel like sooner or later you have to be like, ah, fuck, you know. Like,
I guess I got to get one.
Yeah,
of these things.
I mean, it is like a technological quicksand. Like sooner or later, you're like, all right, I guess I gotta throw in the towel.
Yeah,
and let myself be connected to people.
You would have thought.
Well, that's the thing too. Like they had to with those Samsung TVs, they had to tell people be careful what you're saying in front of the TV because the voice activation the TV has
it goes to a
an
server.
Active microphone that's just sitting in your house now because of the TV,
and it can go to their servers and whatever you say,
like in 1984. But yeah, but that's the case with all of our phones. Yeah.
But what's interesting is that 1984. If we are going toward an Orwellian construct like that. You know, whose big brother is everyone big brother in the way that it's happening now because we're all kind of looking at each other and, right. you know, policing everything that we, that what everyone else does and says, you know, I mean.
That's a really complicated thing, right? Because in when Orwell wrote 1984, it was what, in the late 40s, I mm-hmm. think he wrote that book. And, you know, we had just come off of fascism and Hitler and Stalin and well, we're still in the middle of Stalin and things, it was a simpler time where power was concentrated in the hands of single political parties sure. and, you know, even single, you know, individual men were so powerful. And now I feel like it doesn't work like that. The power is
no,
I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist and I really don't want to sound like that.
Well, you just came from an Oliver Stone movie.
But you know, but to be fair, the technology and particularly the, you know, the interconnectivity of the internet, it did flip a lot of power in one sense mm-hmm. because now essentially everyone, you know, there's no guardian at the gates of information anymore. It's all, I mean, and particularly having just come off the Snowden.
There probably still are, but the lizard people want us to think otherwise.
Oh, no, Matt, what happened? That's...
Guys, I've been watching Ancient Aliens, and I just want to say...
Oh, no! They never arrive. They all just say it could be Ancient Aliens. They never solve anything.
There's no declarative statements on that program, which
no.
makes it endlessly
what it could be.
Frustrating.
Yeah,
some ancient astronaut theorists believe.
Yeah, not even there are theorists about yeah. ancient astronauts. But having just come off a movie like that, how closely did you get to the source material, and how do you tackle that, particularly with Oliver Stone, who's been on the podcast and is also very. Once he starts talking, you kind of just go okay, you know, because right. He's so armed with. You know, with
he knows a lot of history.
He yeah, knows a lot of things that yeah. There's no point for me to go. Well, wait a minute. What about? I got nothing. Like yeah, I don't know.
Right. It's. I mean. Well, I would just try to be curious. You know, and ask a lot of questions. And even though it is sometimes intimidating to ask Oliver questions, I asked him lots and lots of questions. And in fact, what you find with Oliver is. He appreciates it if you stand up to him, if you challenge him, if you even sort of fight him. That's yeah. what he kind of likes and uh-huh. responds to, and that's what you know how the creative process works with him.
Good morning, Joe. Fuck you, well, Oliver.
Fuck you.
Whoa, wait, what?
You'd be surprised how close it kind of came to that. So, No.
I mean, did you hang out with Snowden and talk to him, and was he involved in the project at all?
Let's talk about that another time.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
I totally understand.
Well, we've got a surprise. He's here.
He's here.
Hey, Joe. Hey. He's over in the corner making yeah. this stretch.
No, but I mean, for me, the truth is I really didn't know very much about the Edward Snowden story when Oliver first called me. I was excited and honored to have Oliver call me up. Just because I, you know, love so many of his movies. But in 2013, when the Snowden leaks first came out, I was just really, really busy and I was not up on the news and I didn't really know very much about it. And it wasn't until Oliver asked me that I started doing some reading. And you know, I just read as much as I could and it's, in particular watched Snowden himself and not on, you know, Brian Williams or whatever, where he's very edited. John Oliver, he was great on John Oliver, but you can get a much better sense of him if you watch, you know, one of the longer talks he'll give, you know, long talks with, like he and Lawrence Lessig had a conversation at Harvard I can't think of them off the top of my head, but if you just look on YouTube for kind of the longer Edward Snowden talks, you can get a better sense of what he's trying to say. And unfortunately, it does take some time. The issues he's talking about are complicated to the point where it's very difficult to speak about them in very brief sound bites. You know,
and we're just total soundbite culture now.
Exactly.
People get their news; they'll see like. Four words of a headline, and they go, I got it. And it's actually, like, whoa, you don't got it.
Yeah.
Like,
No, I'm pretty sure I got it.
I got enough information so I could get angry at the internet. Like, no, you don't. Please. Yeah. For the love of God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I feel like part of the conversation that I had with him was you know, if you're representing history, you're also still a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is, you know, you have a point of view and obviously, but I feel like sometimes, you know, some people will go watch a movie like JFK and they'll go, that's a documentary. That's exactly how that happened. And you're like, right. Well, I mean, I guess it could have, but I don't, sure. You know, it is also a movie and it is also
acting. It is a movie, but I don't think that like an Oliver Stone movie is all that much less objective than CNN.
Right.
Because CNN, to me, looks like a show.
Absolutely. You know, it's just and people forget that.
Yeah.
People forget that the news, that the, you know, I think people assume that if they see something on the news, like, oh, well, that's 100% the way it's being presented. Yeah. That is the news.
The man is named Wolf. He's telling me the truth.
He's named after a thing. But the idea that, you know, it is – news is basically capitalist and they all are owned by companies and they all need your attention so they can get sponsors. And so, you know, and they figure out who their demo is and, you know. And
it's then, really pretty similar to what you and I do.
It's almost exactly the same. Yeah. But they're supposedly peddling in some form of reality.
Yeah.
And that's what's sort of scary and how – in a culture that's so littered with so much, so many different points of view all at one time, how do you sift through all of that to get to the nuggets of what may be close to the truth? And the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming.
Well, I'll tell you, since we have the opportunity here to speak in a longer form, I'll take the opportunity to tell you a couple things that I found that when I was reading about all the Snowden stuff that really struck me,
mm-hmm.
And things that maybe don't get talked about so
right.
much.
How hot his girlfriend
on TV
was.
Next. Next. So the first thing that actually really caught my attention was about this guy named James Clapper, who is the director of national intelligence, meaning he works and kind of oversees the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, all these intelligence agencies. Big, big, you know, top dog guy. And in, I think, 2011, he got called before Congress. And as you do when you testify before Congress, he swore to tell the truth. And he was asked, is the NSA collecting millions of phone records on American citizens? And he said, no. Unequivocally, he said, no, sir. And then he said, not wittingly, no. Which is kind of a weird dance around or something. But he just outright lied.
Right.
In just, there's no way you can interpret that in any other way than that he lied. But no one could prove that he was lying until Edward Snowden provided this evidence that showed that the director of national intelligence, I mean, he committed perjury. It's subversive to say that, I guess. But when you get up in front of Congress and you swear to tell the truth and then you tell a lie, that's perjury. So that was one of the first things that really struck me, is like, well, if the director of national intelligence is being asked by a senator, hey, is this happening? Because I, as the representative, the elected representative of the people, am asking you, is it happening? And you just flat out lie, then our government's broken. That's not a democracy anymore. That's no longer a government where the people are having the control that has been promised. The whole – what's so beautiful about the United States of America, you know, the thing that we fought for in the American Revolution, et cetera, is the whole idea that – the American government is accountable to the American people, and the government's not the one in power. The people are the one in power.
Right.
But when some high up government official is lying to the elected representative of the people, then that's not a democracy anymore.
Right.
And so that was one of the things that really struck me. It was like, well, but if that's happening, then what? How could we ever fix that? The only way that could ever really get fixed is if someone like Edward Snowden kind of broke the rules and blew the whistle. And of course, then everyone's going to sort of come down on him and say, hey, traitor, you know, you weren't supposed to, you know, say these things. But it's, you know, you got to look at it. It's Snowden's boss's boss that's really breaking the law. Of course, they're going to blame the little guy, but it's the little guy. All he was doing was kind of telling. He was just telling the truth.
I'm wondering, because I think a lot of people probably, I would imagine a lot of Americans are like, you know what? Just keep me safe. I don't give a shit how you do it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's shady shit going on in government. I just don't want to know about it, as long as my family is safe.
Exactly. So, and in fact, that's funny because that's one of the other things that I found that really struck me, which was that these mass surveillance tools don't actually help prevent terrorism. There isn't evidence of them helping to prevent terrorism. And you have to understand the difference between targeted surveillance versus mass surveillance. Targeted surveillance is perfectly legal, perfectly constitutional. Someone in law enforcement, whether it's the NSA or the CIA or the FBI or police or anybody, says, hey, we have reason to believe that this guy is maybe a problem, and we're going to a court, can prove probable cause, and then, of course, you can go and snoop and listen to his phone calls, read his emails.
Get a flower van, try to put it out in front of them. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's all good. That's targeted surveillance, and that's how they stop terrorism, and they successfully thwart terrorist threats that way all the time. But as far as evidence, actual examples of, hey, we use these mass surveillance tools, these tools that just collect everything from everybody to stop terrorism, they can't come up with any examples. There aren't. They don't. It doesn't work. It's not a useful system because it's too much information, so it's not helpful in finding terrorists.
It's kind of funny that, I mean, I'm sure when you were young and you were like, oh, I want to be a performer, it never occurred to you, like, being a performer means that I might have to research and find out things I wish I didn't know. Yeah. And not just, I get to be Robin, yeah. You know, like, it's a totally different.
Don't belittle the responsibilities of Robin.
No, he's okay,
Robin has a lot on his shoulders.
No, you know what? That was talking out of line there. You're totally right. Robin is very responsible, and he does take over in some capacity. He does get to take over for a bit, and so I'm sorry.
No, but you're right. It's one of the things I love about my job. I get to look into all kinds of things. I get to learn all kinds of things. Before shooting Snowden, I got to learn to, you know, walk on a high wire.
Oh, the Zemeckis movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you successfully walk on a super scary high wire with
thousands of feet in the air.
Jesus Christ.
But yeah, I learned how to do it, and it was Philippe Petit that taught me. He was very intent. He didn't want anybody else to teach me. He's like, don't try it with anybody else before we meet. And he arranged this whole situation for us to spend like 8 straight days together, and he taught me how to do it.
And did you have to overcome the crippling fear of just being on a place where you could fall? And
yeah, it's funny because so when I was doing it, I would always have a safety line, right? And the safety line actually doesn't help you balance, because if they put any pressure on the safety line, it would throw you off balance.
Sure.
It's just there that if you fell, it would catch you.
Sure.
So mentally, I know I'm not going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
But your body kind of doesn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this weird head game. You see actually how little power your mind has over the situation, and how much your emotions are just controlled by kind of this autopilot physical body of yours. Because I learned on like, you know, 2 or 3 feet off the ground, and I got pretty good at it. Easy, where I didn't even have to worry about it too much. I could just kind of do it. But then we shot the movie with the wire 12 feet off the ground, so that they could shoot all the cool angles and whatnot. And just that difference of the extra 10 feet, my body just got all jittery and tight and scared, even though I have the safety thing on. I know nothing bad can really happen. Doesn't matter. My body froze up until I had just spent enough time up there at that height to where it got acclimated and got used to it.
God, I feel like I would get up there and then I would get a foot cramp and then I'd be pissed that I had a foot cramp and then I would fall off.
It's a mental – I mean, you're right, because it's so much mental. If you have to – just keep focused.
I mean, it's an incredible exercise.
You worry about wind gusts. That's what I always found fascinating about him actually doing.
Well, when you see some of those old videos, you'll see like a gust. He'll start to, like, you see him start to take a step, and you'll see it like it move a little bit, and he has to stop for a second.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of let the, basically just like a wave, just sort of like ride the wave a little bit, and then when the gust stops. But Yeah, it's you've been in a tall building, and then you can hear the wind like hitting the building, and there's no part of me that's like, I wish I was out there. Like, I see a window washer, and I feel like my body flushes. I just feel I don't have that gene.
Yeah, well, this movie might make you sick.
is it a little like? Do you is most of the movie just like if you're watching it? Are you like?
I wouldn't say it's most of the movie because you know the way Zemeckis always tells stories is he's very good at getting you invested in the characters.
Yeah.
You know, like when you watch Back to the Future, the whole sequence with the clock tower, I mean, it looks amazing, but a big part of why we love it so much is because you really care about Marty McFly and Doc Brown.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So most of the movie isn't on the wire. It's a lot of the movie is just about this, you know, this guy who's on the one hand a brilliant artist and on the other hand a madman, just completely insane, and sort of the balance of that just in his head, and the, you know, the people that were around him, his friends and you know, co-conspirators who helped him do it, and just the personal relationships of and just the balls that it takes to say, like, we're going to do that. I know it seems impossible, but we're going to do it.
Speaking of balls, I feel like you could slip and fall and rack yourself something fierce up on a high wire.
You could, even with the safety harness.
Though. Yeah, I mean, the safety harness isn't going to keep you from splitting yourself in half with the wire.
And the stunt team told me that all the time.
Look out for your ball. No. Don't talk to me. What else have you been doing in the last couple of years since we saw you?
Mm.
You've done a few movies. Hit Records. Been on. You're going. Is it? What season are you? It's on Pivot.
It's on Pivot, and the second season's about to start.
Second season starting soon.
Yeah. What else have I done? Man, you act like I do things other than work. No, I'm so lucky, dude. It's a funny thing. Because I get into interview situations sometimes where we're like, okay, but but let's talk about, you know, just other things. Like, do you have any hobbies or, like, what do you like to do? Do you like to this, that? And I'm like,
oh, I don't have answers for that either.
I'm telling you, like, yeah, because you do tons of shit too. Like, I see you're always doing shows and various, like, so many things. I love my job. I'm super lucky to get to do it. And I really spend a lot of time doing it.
I mean, it's important because so many people don't even really know what they want to do. And so when you're lucky enough to know what you want to do, and then you're even further lucky that you're able to do that thing, it just feels like, oh, I don't know how I better do this now. I don't know how long this may not be here forever.
You're right.
You know,
like, there's that too. Yeah.
You know, I really need to embrace this while it's a thing. 'Cause who knows?
Yeah. 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 That's interesting. That really resonated with me. Do you have that feeling where, like,
of course,
we're like, oh shit, I don't know if I'll be given these opportunities a year from now. So.
And it almost feels irresponsible to not take them.
Right.
Because I flash back to unemployed me.
Right.
And he's going, what are you doing? Yeah. I would kill to be. Yeah. Why don't you just? And I'm like, okay, I got it. You know, of course I have to do this. Yeah. I have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and have you found a way to balance it? Have you found a way to?
Yes. I have a phenomenal girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
I have a wonderful girlfriend who's taught me the value of, you know, spending time together and going away and taking little, you know, moments and just spending time with her. It really made all the difference. If it was just me, I would be completely running myself into the ground.
Right.
Completely. That and I'm still sense, on the right? edge of doing that, but I still, you know, I still have reserved a side of me that is just for that. And it's really nice.
How do you feel? I'm curious. And how do you talk about your relationship with your girlfriend in public, in press,
sure,
and stuff like that?
I mean, no. Yeah. I mean, she's a somewhat public figure, so I get asked about her.
Ah, okay.
And so she, and so, yeah, and I don't, I've actually even started talking about the relationship in stand-up. So, and she's totally fine with it. Uh-huh. I didn't just do it and be like, you knew what you signed up for. You know, I was like, is it cool if I, and she was like, I don't care. Talk about whatever the fuck you want.
Uh-huh.
But yeah.
I got married recently, which is lovely, lovely,
lovely.
I
see the wedding ring.
Thank you. And, was thank you the right response?
Yeah. Well, it
thank
was. You. It yeah. was. I no, see the I wedding mean,
it's
guy.
A little,
I was...
It's a little gaudy. That diamond's huge.
Damn it.
She's treating him right. Huh? Take him to a nice dinner. Give him a ring.
But, you know, she isn't in the entertainment business or anything like that, and she really doesn't want to be in the public eye.
Yeah.
And that's tough because there's a lot of pressure to share those things, and I don't want to come off guarded or like I you know opaque or something. But,
sure.
But for me, it's really important to have that division. Like there's a part of my life that's just not incorporated into this public persona or performance or, you know, any of it. It's just for me and for her and for, you know, those who, you know, are close friends and family. And that's, to me, that's a really important part of kind of maintaining my sanity.
Yeah. And it's sort of public as we are, but I mean, it's not like, we're not like tabloid couple, but it's just that I would talk about it if someone asked me, but I still feel like there are sections that are just for us. But you're right. It is important because all the other stuff, all the public stuff is based on stuff that's, you know, not always real, or at least, you know, if you're doing a red carpet, you're kind of a version of yourself. You're like, oh, it was, you know, worked on this thing, and it was you know, like if you were like that at home, it'd be irritating, I think, you know.
Yes.
You know, if you had to give well thought out, measured answers to everything to satisfy a soundbite culture.
Soundbite, yeah, exactly.
You know, you'd be, yes, honey, this the dinner that you had delivered was it resonated well, I think, with the younger demographic, and you know, like you'd get fucking punched in the face. And so it is. I think it is important to keep that separate. But obviously, you know, there is some. Because everyone wants to know all things at all times and feels they have a right to now.
Right.
So it is kind of an interesting balance.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still working on it.
Do you go to premieres together, or is she like, I don't even want to do the red carpet, that shit's weird?
Oh no, she would never do that.
Yeah.
That would mortify her. She would, yeah, she, no.
I think maybe that's, you know,
it's kind of awesome.
It is kind of awesome.
I think so too. I think, because those things are kind of mortifying. Yeah. Those red carpets.
Not only that, but if you were with someone who really liked it, then that's sort of a weird, because you don't, you know, it's, I feel like it can be difficult to date if you're somewhat of a public figure, because there can be a myriad of reasons that someone might go out with you and you don't know that.
Right.
So if someone just sort of rejects that right off the bat, you're like, oh, okay, good. You know, you just like me. You don't give a shit about any of that stuff.
Yeah, that really is true. you're right. I mean, and that's just one of many, many, many reasons that I love her, but you are correct.
Do you feel like a married guy now, or is it just like, oh, like once you do it, it doesn't really, you know, like Matt's getting married in October.
You are, congratulations. Yeah,
thank you very much. She's talked to me about maybe not saying so many things.
That's interesting. Like what? Like what? Just, I mean, like, not that you should say the things.
No,
I mean, like, where are
all the things you're not supposed to say.
Yeah, we've just had discussions, like, when we were, even when, like, we're talking about the wedding planning on here, and I said stuff, and I just don't even, there's no real sort of filter on my brain for my life, and now that she is also my life,
right?
Now our life,
mm-hmm.
But I have learned nicely through her that maybe there should be a filter when discussing our sort of our lives and our plans, and so it's just it's been a thing I've had to curb.
Yeah. I would never even, and I would never even have to have someone ask me this, but the stuff that I talk about her on stage is stuff that's sort of, it's publicly known. I would never be like, hey, this one in the old sackaroo sure loved the blah, blah, blah. Like,
Chris, I don't think anyone thought you were saying this one in the old sackaroo.
Well, first of all, I've never been that kind of a guy. Like, not even off the record am I the type of person that is. I'm just not that way.
Right.
I don't know. I kind of was raised by my mom mostly, and I'm just not. I feel weird even just if I get around groups of guys and they're like, we got so much ass last night. I'm like, I feel weird. I'm like, I gotta go. Like, yeah. I just don't communicate that way. So I feel awkward. And I'm not trying to sound like I'm so above everything. It's the 100% truth. If a dude,
it's awkward. Yeah,
it is awkward. Yeah. If a dude starts talking about, like,
I think that's the Catholic in us.
Is it?
Yeah.
My
I don't know. I'm a Jew, and I'm the same way.
Jews and Catholics. They
I mean, there's a lot of similarities.
Is very,
yeah, I've heard.
Is,
yeah.
Very, is very close. But yeah, I know my manager and I have a long running joke about it, because he used to work with some guys, and they were out to dinner one night, and one of them was like,
man, we got so much pussy last weekend, and they kept throwing that word around like it, and afterwards he called me and he was like, I am so glad that this is not how we communicate, and it's so weird to be around it that we'll just randomly call each other during the day and go, hey, a lot of pussy in the oven, so much pussy, oh my god, a mountain of pussy, you know, like it's
well,
so
tell
weird.
Him to stop talking to David Spade.
It's so like that type of communication is so. Are you? Do you consider yourself like a dude's dude, or are you like? Are you more? Do you kind of break what the stereotype?
I mean, I always found the same thing, that it's funny how I think some guys, it seems, and actually this isn't just guys. I think both males and females do this.
Sure.
They are attracted sexually to the potential to be able to tell the story
right.
of what they did more even than the experience itself.
Right.
And the guy version of it is, oh yeah, dude, I got so much fucking pussy.
Yeah.
And you know, you could imagine what you know, what the young lady or old lady version of that.
I was like a Hoover during the time of Hoover.
And just for a second, I felt a drop in my pussy. She's probably dry, you know?
Oh, Matt,
so
Matt,
I was thinking
real.
That
why is the old lady got to be dry?
Yeah,
why?
Seriously.
Why?
You
menopause. I can tell you about menopause. I've been doing a lot of reading for my Ed Snowden movie about menopause.
But you know, here's another question that's related to that, though, that I think about a lot. Like with artists that you love, or any public anybody, how much do you look into their private life outside of their work? Like, you know, there's lots of examples of like. Miles Davis apparently didn't have a great private life.
But he had an excellent heroin dealer.
Or, you know, there's... You
oh,
know,
yeah.
They
or,
could, you know,
or like Peter Sellers. Or like...
I didn't know that one, but yeah,
well, Peter,
exactly.
You know, Peter Sellers is portrayed as having been kind of a monstrous individual to his family. And so, and it does, you know...
Does that impact you when you watch a Peter Sellers movie?
It's hard not to think about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's hard not to think... I mean, on the one hand, you can appreciate – I'll tell you what. You can. I feel like on one hand, part of your brain can appreciate the technical aspects of it, the sort of spiritual aspects are like, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
if having that much genius meant that he was that horrible to people, mm-hmm. I have a problem with that. And certainly certainly in the case of someone like Cosby, completely ruined. Can't get into it anymore. Can't watch him anymore. Can't – like all those charming family stories, like it's all, I just can't. I can't anymore. So that was a case where it was completely, completely ruined for me. But I think it also depends on, you know, what the stories were, how much, like where the rumors might be. And the, you know, I like to give people the benefit of the doubt, but if it seems like something was either proven or there was an alarming amount of evidence to suggest, then of course it's hard to separate.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, you know, there is an example to be learned from it, which is, you know, handle your shit well and try to be a good person.
Sure,
don't, you know, because our business does attract broken people, and then it breaks them further. Yeah. And so, you know, if you are fortunate enough to find a nice partner, as I have, and you and Matt, and then you know, don't take it for granted, because those types of things, I think, can tether us to reality. Keep your feet on the ground.
Yeah.
And knowing that the alternative is, you know, not the alternative. It could always be worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that stuff when I just go, I'm glad that I don't have like a monstrous demon that I have to battle with every single day.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Yeah. Because even I feel like I'm super lucky, and you know, I was born to great loving parents who, you know, I feel like I don't have a lot of stuff to contend with like that, and even still it's sort of difficult to just, like you say, keep your feet on the ground, you know, working in the sort of insane business that we do. And I can only imagine if I was having to contend with whatever doubts or demons that doing this kind of work would just be
impossible. I mean, it's so funny. It's like if I didn't know who you were and I just met you and I didn't know who you were, it's like the level of stuff that you do. But then just talking to you, I was like, Joe. He's just a dude. Like, he's not. No, he's in like a bunch of the biggest movies. No, come on. He's like a regular guy. What are you talking about?
Thanks, man.
I mean, it's and I think ultimately that's probably one of the best scenarios you can hope for in this business is to be able to do the things you like and not get chewed up or have your soul completely. And I think that's why it's important to have interests outside of it. A passion project like Hit Record or a nice partner or, you know, like a good family and a cool brother and cool parents. And, you know, it's like that's some of those things you're just very lucky that you happen to have a cool family. And that's
so grateful.
You know,
yeah.
And so
that's and I do and I feel protective of it. And so when I go on, you know, some in various certain press venues, you know, where you kind of receive pressure to like, well, so tell me, you know, more about your wife or your married life or whatever. I do feel protective. I don't
you know what though, but the thing
it.
That's irritating about that is that it's not like if you could, because you know they're just trying to exploit you for a story to get views or to get ratings or to get attention.
That's right.
And I don't, like, you know, if I ask someone something like that, I'm not trying to break a story. It's like, oh, I'm really interested to know, and if you don't want to talk about it, don't talk about it. But the pressure that you're feeling is because you can tell that it's coming from a selfish place, and they don't really want to know you. Mm-hmm. They just want to see what they can crack open and, you know, and get hits on a website for. And that's why you should be protective of it.
Yeah, you're right. Well, and I've felt that both times that I've been, you know, done this podcast with you. It feels like we're having a conversation, two dudes, like, kind of getting to know each other.
One of these days, we could have a conversation without
microphones.
Microphones?
Nah, boring.
Nah, never happened.
Boring.
Nope. If you can't record it, it doesn't exist. It does not exist. Well, do you want to play? When season two of Hit Record is coming out?
This Friday is the first episode, June 12th.
On Pivot?
On Pivot, which is a cable channel that, you know, it just started. Not a lot of people necessarily know about it.
They attracted a lot of good talent, though. Like, Pivot, there's some really cool programming.
And there's reason, you know, because the guy who started Pivot is a guy named Jeff Skoll. And Jeff Skoll, he was one of the – he was the first president of eBay.
Oh, wow.
And so he exited eBay with a lot of money, let's just say, and since then he started so many things, and he supports so much social entrepreneurship, and I mean, he does a ton of stuff. But in the media side of his career, he started a company called Participant Films, and in the movie industry for the last 10 years, they've contributed to so many great movies, like the one that I was in is called Lincoln. They were, you know, one of the companies involved in that, or An Inconvenient Truth, or what else? The Help. Tons and tons of movies. And but they operate on this thing that I think is really cool called the double bottom line, which means they have the normal bottom line where they're responsible to, you know, be a lucrative and sustainable company. But the other bottom line is Jeff holds them accountable to, this has to have a certain amount of positive social impact, and we have to be able to measure that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, with every one of their productions, with every movie, like for example with Lincoln, they spent the money to create an entire high school curriculum around the movie, and send that curriculum along with a copy of the DVD to every public high school in the United States. And they do that kind of thing for every production, and every production is different. They have some kind of campaign that they also put a ton of money into so that the production will have, you know, some kind of measurable social impact. And they've done really well as a film company for about a decade. And so Pivot, they just started last year, 2014, Pivot started, and they're, you know, getting into the TV game.
That's great.
Yeah. So I feel good, you know, working for that guy, And also, by the way, I don't think we probably could have made our show anywhere else because
I think if you just were doing hit record, you could still be able to say like I'm successful, you know, because it's a thing, it's a passion project, and it's something that's very important to you, and a thing that's for the community, you know, and but then you just start leveling, you start adding all stuff on top of that, and it's, you know what, it's best that you don't think about it too much because you should stay grounded and cool.
Thanks.
But congratulations and congratulations on the wedding, and
thank you very much.
And enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this. Perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients. Popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.